Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Commercial Real Estate Library Podcast. This is the show where we connect you with the brightest minds in the commercial real estate industry. Today, we have a very special guest. We are joined by the Chief City Planner for the City of Toronto, Greg Lintern. Toronto, like all global cities, is a challenging city to plan for. We have heavy infrastructure demands. We have a housing affordability crisis. And a lot of these problems are only becoming greater. The man in charge of solving a lot of these issues is Greg Lintern. So we have a very interesting discussion. For those of you who care about city building, city planning, this is the episode for you. Before we dive in, I want to say a quick thank you to our sponsor, KMB Law. KMB Law are corporate real estate lawyers that specialize in the acquisition, disposition, and financing of commercial real estate. KMBlaw.com. Please support us by supporting them. Enjoy the episode. Hey everyone, welcome back to the Commercial Real Estate Library. I'm Damon Tamanawala. You know my co-host, Garrett McGillivray. And today we're joined by Chief City Planner for the City of Toronto and Executive Director, Greg Lintern. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Looking forward to a good chat.
Yeah, us too.
Good.
So before we jump into everything, we want to get right into the detail.
You got a lot of ground to cover.
Yeah, no kidding. Big city.
We're here for about, we got 4 hours booked with them. So yeah. Lots of time.
It's not enough.
Can you tell us a little bit about, just for context, a little bit about how you got to where you are as the chief planner for the City of Toronto?
Wow, that's a great question. Should I tell you about my grade 10 urban geography class?
As much as you want to tell us, you're willing to divulge?
Yeah.
I think I could trace my interest in city planning to my grade 10 urban geography class. Maybe at that time, a wannabe architect or maybe a pilot or all those things that kids think about what they want to be. But I got inspired by that, I would think specifically. And from that point on, for me, it was pretty clear that I wanted to kind of work on cities, whatever that meant at that point in time. Mm-hmm. I can remember a project we did where you had to design a city and kind of thinking, oh, this is really cool. And really never looked back. I kind of had a clear line of sight that that's what I wanted to do. You know, 35 years later, I look back and it's just a lot of hard work and, you know, being interested in what comes at you when you do this work and all the change that you get to see. And I do like the fact that you experience, you know, the routine of cities, but you also experience, especially in Toronto, a lot of change. And I like thinking about the problems and the challenges that come with that change. Like, it's something that I like, or I would say that I love it. So It keeps you infatuated.
I would hope so. You're the head of the pyramid right now. So I'm very glad that you love it. That's what we want.
You gotta love it.
That is also remarkable when I think about what I was doing in grade 10 and the problems that I was thinking about.
What were you doing?
Not thinking about
selling real estate or
selling
not quite
yet. Yeah, I was already. I had sold my first building and then I
did his first deal.
I did my exactly. No, we won't dive down that rabbit hole, but, but okay. And so now you've been at working with the City of Toronto for how long now?
35 years in different capacities, different roles, right. Everything from the photocopier machine on up to the chief planner, what I'm doing today. But I've worked in the different geographies of the city, suburbs, downtown, different kinds of projects. So it's never been without a change for me personally as well, mm-hmm. and professionally, which helps you in any career. Mm-hmm. I think that kind of change up is good for you. So I've had that opportunity at the city, which is one of the selling points of working for the city, is being able to do different things and mm-hmm. still working in the organization.
That's a pretty unique thing, just having ground up knowledge of like an organization, like the city is an organization.
Yeah.
But like seeing it from all sorts of different angles, because it's easy for somebody to come in by doing like an urban planner consulting in Chicago and then just being like, hey, I'm chief city planner now of Toronto type of thing. And it's like, well, you don't truly know the city. Like, you know cities, but like you don't know the urban feel as somebody that's sort of been doing it for like 35 years.
And you know, some of that's transferable. I talk to planners and architects and development people from cities all over the world, and there is a lot of commonality in what we're challenged with.
Mm-hmm.
So some of that is definitely transferable, but then there's a lot of good local knowledge that also really comes in handy.
Mm-hmm. So just speaking from sort of a more higher level perspective, a lot of planners have, that I've at least talked to, have certain philosophies, because some might be more hardliners on transit and just, you know, trying to get that right off the ground, and that's their main focus. Some people are more worried about intensification and increasing densities across, you know, different markets, whatever it may be.
Mm-hmm.
What would your philosophy be?
My philosophy, planning.
As a planner, yes.
And this isn't about philosophers. I would say, you know, I look at it, and I've talked about this in different forums that I've been in over the last couple of years. I try to talk about it from a values-driven point of view. And the approach that you bring to city planning or problem solving. So I've identified some values, and you could have your own value set as a professional. But I look at things like humility. I talk to the staff, our staff, a lot about being able to be empathetic with the population of the City of Toronto and understand their daily experience, not to kind of project onto them, but actually to listen to people and understand deeply what they're experiencing. Walk in their shoes, I say that a lot. Don't assume. I talk a lot about generosity, that remember that we're all, you know, we're all living here, like 2.9, are we 2.9 million people now in the City of Toronto? So we're already kind of living in this concentrated space. We're already being very generous with our lives and our space. And planners have to think about, you know, always talking to people about being maybe a little bit more generous, you know, with their space, because we're growing and we're inviting more people to live here. And that's a challenge. I talk about resilience a lot and how we've tackled problems. I think we have to be aware that we've been able to tackle problems. I'm a bit of an optimist when it comes to being able to tackle some of the difficult challenges that we've got. And resiliency from a climate change perspective is enormous, but also resiliency in just your philosophy of, you'd ask about philosophy, your philosophy of life and knowing that you can solve problems, you have the capacity to solve problems. And finally, you know, I talk about perspective, that we're in this fast-paced world where everybody wants an answer yesterday and no one's got time for analysis and all that other stuff, but planners actually need to spend time thinking, working on data, coming up with good advice, a good solid advice, good analysis, and bringing perspective to the conversation. Everyone's kind of in a hurry for a solution, but sometimes it's good to take a little bit of time, do a little bit of work for better outcomes. At the end of the day, so that's a long answer to your philosophy question, but I think it's important to approach it from a values point of view, which is what I try to do.
Yeah, you got to be human, and it's a city occupied by humans.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
Can you talk about, like, being at the city for 35 years? Can you talk about some of the major shifts that we've seen over that time period in planning?
Some of the major shifts. Well, I mean, it's interesting to think about the city and how we've grown. Population, you know, you use the downtown as a bit of a roadmap for that. And I've been working at the city when things have been very quiet, you know, through recessions, for example, in the early 90s. We've been on a real run since that time. Probably more than 20 years of growth. But what we're coming to realize that growth isn't happening evenly, that some parts of the city are, I would say, challenged by lack of investment and lack of renewal. They're kind of plateaued. And some areas of the city are kind of almost overheated and have a whole different set of problems around providing the right kind of infrastructure to support that growth.
Young and Eglinton, for instance.
Young and Eglinton, right. Parts of the downtown. So you kind of, over the course of that period of time, we've kind of gone from, people used to say more of a provincial city over a long period of time, to much more of a global city that has serious global challenges. And then inside of that is this Toronto story about this unevenness that I focus on a lot, because some of the change that's been happening is focused, where we have our transportation network, the subways. If you look at a map of Toronto, you see a heat map, literally, you see the development and activity centered around the subway. But you see other areas of the city that don't have good transit, for example, and there is a lot less happening in those areas. Mm-hmm. And we also have a long kind of trend line around income and, frankly, racial segregation that people don't talk about as much here. But the data shows that we're increasingly polarized around neighborhoods that, and again, it's about where things are happening and not happening, but areas where people are being more separated by their income than they ever have been over mm-hmm. that 30-year period of time. So my job in thinking about that unevenness is about what we can do in those areas to turn that around.
What kind of stuff can you do to basically turn around like a 30-year polarizing, shift in one particular direction?
Well, I mean, we've been talking a lot about transit expansion, but I also use the word mobility. So you think about mobility broadly, you think about, walking, cycling, certainly using personal vehicle, transit of all modes, LRTs, buses, subways, regional rail. But you think about that as a mobility network, and you graph that onto the city, and you look for areas where mobility is weaker than other areas. That tends to correlate with those areas that have been left behind. Mm-hmm. So one way to get at that is to invest more in mobility, because that literally becomes a rising tide that lifts other boats and brings that access to opportunity to more people than it does currently. If you use a principle of a 5, 10, 15-minute walk to a higher-order transit, for example, and try to stretch that network more and more, then you will open up opportunity for more people who haven't traditionally had that. You also open up housing opportunity, housing development opportunity to areas that currently may not have the land value to support redevelopment. Mm-hmm. You guys probably know all about proformas in your business, but that is behind a lot of what's going on in the land development business. And some of the math doesn't pencil out in areas of Toronto. Some of it, of course, you can make lots of money. Right. Some areas it doesn't attract the investment proposition, if you will. If you bring if you improve transit access, then you improve the opportunity to build housing, both affordable and market housing. But it's kind of a simple equation around: if you improve the mobility network, you expand access to opportunity, you bring more investment to more areas of the city, and I think you begin to turn that trend around.
On that note, would there ever be any consideration to just reduce development charges in certain areas of Toronto to kind of lead to that expansion, or at least act as a catalyst?
Yeah, I mean the DC, I would say that's been debated. Right. And there are different schools of thought on varying DCs to provide incentives. Toronto has never gotten into that business heavily. We currently do not charge development charges for affordable housing, rental affordable housing.
Right.
And that's the one incentive that we have to lower the per unit cost. Other fees and charges are also exempt. So projects like our open door program, for example, where we package up or bundle up a range of incentives to lower the per unit cost for development of affordable housing. But the other side of the DC coin is about infrastructure, and the city has a 10-year capital plan to support growth. So if you want to start giving holidays for development charges, you got to find another way to pay for it.
Right.
And so that's the kind of tension, you're smiling, but that is the tension in the discussion, is that we don't want to leave kind of livability behind. Well, let's build housing, but you got to think about all the other things that come with housing to build what we call complete communities. So you need the pipes, you need the roads, the parks, the community centers, the daycares to, you know, make sure that you're building a livable community. If you only build housing because you want to, you know, have a holiday on charges,
right,
then what are you going to do to pay for all the other stuff? And we seem to be really good here at the city about growing housing, you know, we're especially on the market side, not so good on the affordable side. But we struggle with keeping up on the infrastructure demands. We're always a little bit behind the eight ball on that. People are always saying we don't have enough transit, or they're worried about the number of parks that we have in the city and things like that, especially in our high growth areas.
Right.
So you got to watch that. You'll never hear me saying that we don't grow without growing the infrastructure.
Right. It's funny asking you these questions because, like, we obviously have so many questions, but you've obviously thought about all of this stuff for a long time. Okay.
It'll be actually interesting because we're going to be speaking with Options for Homes I think in a month or something like that.
Yeah.
So we'll get the load down on all affordable rental units
right.
from them.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, you know, the market isn't building affordable housing per se by our definition. So, and that's the challenge in a city, in a global city like Toronto. It's no different really than some of the other challenges that cities like London or other cities have. We're kind of in that family now of cities that have a big global challenge on their hands with affordability.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I take the view that we can't supply our way to affordable housing. We have to have a more direct role for some sort of incentive-based package around relief from fees, which we do with Open Door in exchange for affordable. But more directly, you know, there were decades a long time ago now where there was a direct government role in supporting the construction of affordable. And the market simply isn't doing that on its own. So there has to be more of an investment from the provincial and federal government. The city is trying to do its part with its, an example of that is the Housing Now initiative, where we're taking city land and we're putting it on the market. I think the first sites have been put out there. We're actually leading the zoning piece, so we're pre-zoning, which I think reduces the uncertainty for the market.
Right.
And but in exchange for that, we are saying you got to build us a certain number of units of affordable, and that's the kind of business terms that we're putting out to the market, and we'll see what kind of interest we get from that. But we think that's another way that we can play a direct role, but we would like the provincial and federal government to also play a direct role in advancing, you know, whether it be through their own land or other government supported programs to see the construction of affordable.
With that in mind, so, you know, obviously there have been even recent changes such as Bill 108, which I hope we can dive into. But, you know, like the deferral of development charges is one thing, right? But how do you, actually a better question. The election was last night.
Jeez.
How do you foresee any changes coming with Justin Trudeau's new term, or his interactions with our premier, and then their interactions with the city?
Well, I think the mayor released a statement last night, just putting it on the record again that the city, from our perspective, needs support building transit. And areas that I'm involved with, his letter mentioned a number of things, but certainly support building transit and advancing the transit network, and support with affordable housing. So those, you know, those are kind of our razor-focused issues that we feel there is a significant role for the federal government to play, and that's, you know, that's the conversation that we've been having. We've gotten support, and we want to continue to get the support from the federal government to advance that.
Okay. In terms of, like, the affordable housing front, like, is there any thought to, like, making it easier to rezone properties to apartment-based uses to obviously increase supply and thereby, you know, raising down demand, potentially lowering the inexorbitant cost to rent a one-bedroom?
Yeah, so, I mean, that's about housing.
No kidding.
You know, expanding the choice that's out there for or Torontonians or future residents. We had 77,000 people come to Toronto in 2018, so we're growing. And we project upwards of, you know, close to 1 million people by 2041, new people.
And sorry, the City of Toronto, not
City
Greater
of Toronto.
Toronto.
Just, you know, the 416.
Wow.
Yeah, okay. So it's a lot. And so what can we do, you know, about that? And you mentioned one part of the toolkit, which is pre-zoning, which I'm a great believer in. I think you bring certainty to the discussion for the residents of a neighborhood. Let's say you have a discussion on about their main street, and you say, you know, we're going to work on a vision for that neighborhood for mid-rise buildings. And you have that discussion with the neighborhood, and you put in place and you pre-zone. We've actually done that, I think 19 of 25 avenue studies we've done, we have pre-zoned that avenue segment. And you can see places like Sinclair, for example, where there's as-of-right zoning for mid-rise, which is between 5 and 11 stories, depending on the width of the street.
Right.
But you'll see like 9, 10, 11-story buildings on Sinclair, where the zoning's already in place. And that brings... You know, the expectation for the community is they understand what they're going to get going forward into the future. And the expectation for the development side of the equation is that they know what they're going to get. So you hopefully reduce speculation. You know, the land value is set around the expectation that the zoning provides. And you make the process more simple because, you know, you may need a minor variance or site plan. But really, it's not a big deal to get that project going quickly and get it to market. So I definitely believe that's part of the toolkit is pre-zoning as much as we can. You see the cranes in the city, you know, I don't know what the last count was, 237, I think I checked some website somewhere. There's a lot of mid-rise and tall buildings under construction, by far and away the most in North America, like by a country mile. And so, you know, people see, they see the tall buildings, but, and we're getting most of the unit production out of the tall buildings, I grant you that. We're getting a hefty amount out of the pipeline for mid-rise, I think around 30, 35,000 units right now in the pipeline. There are other things we can do, though, with pre-zoning on a much smaller scale about making it easier, for example, for secondary suites. So we've changed the zoning bylaw to make that permitted citywide. You know, as long as you have a good architect and check the building code, I always say.
Fire escapes.
You need your, absolutely, 100%. You can build, you can include a second suite in your house with no parking as of right in Toronto.
Okay.
That's new.
And I think
you
there's
can build
also
a laneway suite as well.
Yeah, I was going to say.
You can build a laneway suite now as of right if you have laneway access, obviously. No parking again. So we're on a small scale, you know, again, you see the cranes, but we're trying to do something right across the spectrum of need and choice to make it productive as possible for the, you know, the economy to produce housing. It's not a panacea, but again, we're trying to make that more and more variable or address the variables more and more in more different ways than we can in the past than we did in the past.
And Greg, do you know how many people are I guess, as of right, but is there some way that you can measure how many people are taking advantage of the laneway?
Yeah, actually, we just had a check-in yesterday, I think, or today, and it's only been in place for 1 year, like 12 months, literally. And we've got about just over 50 building permits issued. So for something brand new, and about maybe 115 odd inquiries, like working their way through the review process.
Right.
So for something that's brand new for Toronto, I'd say that's pretty good. It's not going to produce, you know, thousands of units overnight. That's why I go back to that word I used earlier about you got to keep things in perspective. But it will produce, I think, over time, more and more interest and become more the norm to see that type of thing. And whether you're, you know, you're aging in place and you got kids out the back in your laneway suite, or you want to put your parents out there and live in the house, or you like your relatives, or maybe you just want to rent to supplement your mortgage, it opens up something that wasn't previously available. Mm-hmm. You could always, you can do a secondary suite as well, let's say in your basement or whatever. So again, we're trying to open that up and make it more permissive.
Mm-hmm. So 2 points on that. First, my brother actually wants to do that exactly, suite thing, because he's a minimalist, and like he doesn't use his upstairs.
He wants to live in it.
Yeah, he wants to live in it with his wife and his daughter, and he's there just like, screw it, and then just rent his house. He's a semi-detached near like Christie Pits, so it's like a perfect spot.
He's probably got a laneway there.
Yeah, no, he has one.
Yeah.
Second, I believe I saw a laneway suite for sale in the... I don't know if can they be for sale? Can they be severed and sold?
So one of our conditions,
because
of this issue with changing the character of neighborhoods, there's always a bit of attention around land severances.
Mm-hmm.
So our laneway suite permission requires it to be tethered to the house and not severed.
Okay.
So in that respect, it supports a rental, more of a rental choice. Yeah. We can't zone for tenure, but we can certainly set it up so that that's the option, really. You can sell your house with the laneway suite.
Yeah.
It's but we are not, you know, what you're asking there is another tension in the city, which is around the whole real estate world and what some people call the financialization of housing, which is, you know, 30, 40 years ago, it was a home, and 30, 40 years today, it's your retirement.
Mm-hmm.
You guys know all about that probably.
Oh, yes.
And so it's become an investment tool more and more. And this has created a real tension around around how people perceive the housing challenge. Right. Some people perceive it as a right. And when you think about it, in a society like ours, I think housing is a right. Certainly people who are challenged with housing options would see it that way. And when we think of it only as an investment, and buying and selling and flipping and all the different things that go on with real estate these days, we get away from, I think, what the public interest is, which is about meeting the housing need of the population.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in planning, there's always that tension between the public interest and the private interest. It's essentially a big negotiation that's always going on about what happens with the marketplace and what we do with rules and regulations to temper the market and, you know, soften the edges sometimes of the, of the market. So housing is a big place where you see that playing out more and more.
Mm-hmm. I got one. Speaking of, we don't have an order to any of these, so we just kind of jump in. But speaking to changing the characteristics of neighborhoods, actually, I have a two-part question. When we talk about avenues, a lot of, like, I grew up in the Beaches, Queen Street East
kind
of neighborhoods. We have a lot of those six-story buildings from Daniels Corp. And
actually, you don't have that many in the Beach, but anyway.
Not too many. It's getting there. Yeah. More Leslieville kind of area right now. But what we found, like, at least from a sales perspective, is that a lot of these developers they can't make the economics work. They can't make the numbers work for just six stories. Is there any... is there any consideration to expand that to a higher amount of store, maybe 9 to 12. I know. Yeah.
So, I mean, it goes back to what I was talking about earlier about putting in place as a right zoning so that everybody understands, you know, what you're going to get
right
out mm-hmm. of a development proposition. And we've reviewed different avenues, and there are different scales. Ossington, for example, there's a little pocket there. It's quite popular. Depending on what block you're on, it could be 4, 5, or 6 stories that's permitted, for example.
Right.
In the beach, it's the same. Parts of the beach are quite special, and people think about it differently. And again, 4, 5, or 6. Whereas up on the Danforth, it's wider, and it can support, the lot depths are different, and it can support slightly taller. Or you go to a Shepherd, for example, or a Wilson Avenue, and you get even more opportunity there. So what we try to do is size the permission for the context.
Right.
But at the same time, bring some certainty for both the residents and the development industry. So we don't get into this kind of crazy site-by-site negotiation all the time. And it, I mean, you know, the density that you can achieve on an avenue, just think about it. Instead of going up, you're spreading it out.
Right.
And it's going to play out over a longer period of time. But again, we've got tens of thousands of units that are proposed or being constructed on the avenues. So it'll, you know, they're transforming. We've got old Victorian main streets in the former city of Toronto. We've got broad suburban avenues in the city of Toronto. There's 140 kilometers of avenues out there that can support intensification. So, and we're doing our level best to kind of have those conversations and set that up for success.
It's actually interesting having the pre-zoning concept, because when a lot of people buy land, they buy it on speculative value because right. they're just assuming right. they're like, we're going to get an 80-story condo on this baby.
Seems and like, obviously, well, that's what everyone wants.
Yeah, and everybody wants. There's like, we're just going to hammer the city yeah. down, hammer the OMB.
Yeah. yeah.
But then when you have
mine's the key piece. That's what they yeah. say.
Yes, yeah, I've exactly. heard that. Or I've got the landmark site.
yeah. Exactly.
Really?
Best site.
It's a city full
universe.
Of landmark sites.
Yeah. I know.
I've heard them all.
But then having that pre-zoned element and the hard cap on, say, like, this is a 6-story site,
yeah.
that eliminates all speculative value for it. And mm-hmm. then therefore, because the major issue why a lot of mid-rise buildings don't work is because land is priced at, like, high-rise density land everywhere. Because
That's
everybody's
right.
like, no, you can get yeah, a you're condo welcome. Here,
100%. You know, property, you know, a lot of our main streets are owned by, and you probably know this, individual owners.
Mm-hmm.
Families that have owned the properties for decades. And they're income properties. They've got a viable restaurant. They've got another business that, you know, and they're kind of on, they run their life on an income model. That's their income.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of land sits productively in that income model for a long, long time. You know, somebody passes away, the business shuts, the family decides we don't want it anymore. So you see that dynamic in Toronto mm-hmm. a lot lately where property gets handed down and comes into an option for redevelopment.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that kind of dynamic across our main streets. Or you see, you know, transformations happening where a street used to be a street full of car dealerships, for example, but or gas stations and other things that we don't see as much of these days. So some of those sites, which are really good sites, come online for mid-rise development.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you asked me earlier about this transformation over 30 years, and that's one of the things that you slowly begin to see is that intensification taking place, which is, I think, really positive for those neighborhoods because you've got a chance. Let's say you're in a neighborhood in a house, you really love it, all your friends are there, your doctor's there, your dentist is there, your book club's there. You're getting older, you don't want to move out. You want to find a new place to live in that area.
Right.
And so mid-rise or maybe a laneway suite or whatever is an option for you to stay there, stay in your social network, stay close. Maybe you don't own a car anymore, right? So there's a lot of, you know, it makes a lot of sense for a lot of people if you provide greater housing options on that basis.
Can we take a dive into Bill 108?
I guess so.
All right.
Oh, you had a two-part question.
Two-part. Oh, my second part of the question was...
That's why I didn't ask any follow-up questions, Dana. But
okay, man. The second part of the question was not as serious, but like, because you kind of answered it already, but you know, you see avenues like the Danforth, for instance, that actually have a subway line right there.
Yeah.
You know, how is, do you see a future where that is high rise territory, and why not? You know,
yeah,
obviously neighborhoods.
Yeah. I mean, I would just say that there's an equally valid opportunity there to spread the density out, and the coexistence of our low-rise neighborhoods is with change along the avenues is something that you're beginning to see across Toronto. And again, it is like lying down a tall building across a longer stretch. I think the tall building intensity that you see in the city is more appropriate for the centers that we planned at Yonge and Eglinton, or North York Centre, Scarborough, Etobicoke, the waterfront,
right,
the downtown. There's lots of opportunities for that, but there's more than one way to create density, and you can create it at a really low scale. Intensification, when I talk about the generosity that people have to endure in this city, we've got to do it carefully and not haphazardly. I think people expect that we're going to have density and growth, but they're going to, as I said earlier, they're going to expect the infrastructure that comes along with it, and you cannot hope to keep up with that level of growth if you don't have a degree of planning that goes on and coordination with the provision of infrastructure. I think if you've got 80-story buildings popping up everywhere, I think you've got anarchy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And nobody likes that.
No.
Right. Okay. Did you have a question, or did you?
Go on. Go on, David.
I can go? All right. Okay. So Bill 108, this big bill, what was it, released in June, right? Something like that.
Yes.
This early in the summer. To do with the More Homes, More Choice Act,
yes,
from Premier Ford. So the bill has a lot of big claims about reducing the time that the development is going to take, or entitlement's going to take, to go through the process.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, but not too much detail. So I'll rattle off a few questions.
Okay.
How is the inclusionary zoning going to be taken into account?
Okay, so inclusionary zoning, which is basically seeing a percentage of every housing project produce a component of affordable housing. That's basically what it means, and has been utilized in many cities around North America. The legislation continues the permission that the previous bill had, Bill 139. From the previous government, so Bill 108 didn't change it.
Okay.
It does limit its application to certain major transit station areas, which are station areas in proximity or close proximity to existing or planned transit stations, 500 to 800 meters. Or in an area where we have a community permit system or development permit system.
Right.
So it's set up some... it continues the basis for permitting inclusionary zoning, but it restricts it more than we would like. We would like it to be more permissive. The other issue with inclusionary zoning that the government has put forward is that they have also changed the municipal, the provisions of the Planning Act that how we secure and pay for municipal services. So inside Bill 108 is a change to three tools: our Section 37 provisions, the Section 42 provisions, which is the parkland provisions. Every development pays parkland levy.
Right.
And thirdly, DCs, soft DCs, so certain kinds of DCs. The Planning Act change rolls all those three together into something new called a community benefits charge.
Right.
And it's called a community benefits authority. We have to do a background study to set up what that community benefits authority is going to be.
Okay.
And that will have an impact on inclusionary zoning, because inclusionary zoning and the CBC or community benefits charge, they all go on your pro forma. And we want it to work. So we are in the process of waiting for the government to produce the regulations behind the CBC charge so that we can understand the impact on the pro forma, so that we can do the calculations to basically roll out an inclusionary zoning package that makes sense. There's no point in putting in something where you've got everybody screaming at you that it doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
So it has to happen in a certain, it's complicated and it's finances, but it has to happen in a certain order. So the legislation has been enacted, but the regulations have not been produced.
Okay.
So until the regulations are out and we can do the calculations, we can figure out how it's going to impact everyone. We've been consulting about inclusionary zoning, and we're going to be advancing ideas about it, but we can only take it so far before we see the rest of the deal on the CBC charge, if all that makes sense.
Yeah, it
you,
doesn't.
You get an A.
You kind of answered like three or four of my questions there in one.
Yeah, it's all related.
Are there any early, so we're still a ways away then,
yeah,
but
yeah.
Are there any early seeds of maybe surprises that?
No, I don't think so. We published in June a proposal for inclusionary zoning, so people can see that on our website. There is a report that outlines an approach,
right,
a general approach for inclusionary zoning. And it is kind of mindful of the impact, while at the same time, the city approves on average about 21,000 housing units a year. If we could get a small percentage of that as affordable, we'd be doing really well on that shortfall that we're confronted with by not producing affordable housing. Remember, the market's not producing affordable housing, so we need that government nudge, regulatory nudge through inclusionary zoning to really convert some of that juice into affordable product, so that more people who are in need of affordable housing, can their needs can be met.
Okay. I stop me if I keep going too far, but
doesn't he get to ask a question?
He does, but he takes longer.
No, I don't take longer. I'm just letting it all
more
sink
thoughtful.
In.
Yeah. Perhaps.
Well, no, because like affordable housing is so very important, because my girlfriend's sister actually works in London. She works as part of the housing. I don't know what the organization is called, but she assists
council or something. Yeah.
Getting people into affordable housing units, mm-hmm, basically, that are in need. And like the people that she deals with, I'm just like, wow, like they're have not had the dice roll the right way for their life.
Yeah.
And like they're struggling, and the affordable housing stock is so very limited.
Yeah.
And it's like there's a wait list of like 500 people trying to get into these things. And it's like,
I mean, we have to work hard to retain what we've got. We have hundreds of thousands of rental units in Toronto, mm-hmm, actually, but they were all built decades ago.
Yeah,
some of them are actually coming under threat for redevelopment. So we have regulations that require their replacement.
Yeah.
So we work really hard at retaining what we have as part of the strategy. If you redevelop a site that has an apartment building on it, most of them small apartment buildings, we get their replacement as part of the approval. That's mm-hmm the way our policies and regulations work. But we have to grow it too, right?
Right.
So you retain and you try to expand it. So you're identifying an issue in London that's very similar to here,
mm-hmm,
and the Ontario government and the city, the former city and metro government, actually built, housing decades ago. Those are generally the Toronto Community Housing sites that we have. They're Canada's largest landlord. I think it's 60,000 units. But some of those sites are revitalization sites. So Regent Park, for example, is another example of how the city can use its land resource, provided that we, replace and renew those units. And we've been doing that in a number of what we call Revite sites, Alexandra Park, Tridel, I think, is working there. Yep. Daniels has been working at Regent. I think it's Metropia that's working up at Lawrence Heights. Great opportunities to kind of reintegrate those housing communities into their surroundings, build new services, new community centers.
Right. A lot of those guys
New housing, market housing, retail. So you're kind of re-knitting those communities back into their surrounding communities.
A lot of those guys are doing great jobs too.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know,
no, I mean, they're winning awards and they're, I mean, I think people see it for what it is now, which is a great opportunity. I mean, these buildings were built 40, 50, 60 years ago. They, you know, the roofs are shot, the furnaces are gone, the windows are bad. You're either going to economically, you know, do all that work in a building that really isn't the best for housing, especially housing families, or you're going to rebuild them from scratch and utilize that land resource, I think, more effectively. Mm. And, you know, we're intensifying all of those sites. Those, you know, the population of Regent Park is going way up. I think 17,000 people are going to live there when it's all said and done. And you can see similar growth in some of the other areas. So again, it's a really great opportunity to partner with the private sector and get some good community building done.
Just narrowing in specifically to the rental replacement units. So when somebody obviously becomes a developable site and then they take down, say, 15 types of units, everything, and they build a condo, then they're furnishing, say, 15 new rental affordable rental units in that building. Is there a timeline in which they don't have to be affordable anymore, or is it like for life type of thing, for the life?
Yeah, so that's generally negotiated. I think those terms vary between probably 10 and 25 years.
Okay.
And those situations all vary.
Okay. Well, I'm trying to think of what else.
OMB?
Yeah. Great point. How was the transition from the OMB to LPAT back to the new LPAT? How has that affected you guys?
You know, I think it's too early to tell. The bill just came into effect just in September 2019. So these things, you know, they're very subtle, and you don't notice the changes like a light switch going off, like you would with a light switch going off.
Right.
You know, my focus has always been on working with developers, and we've got a lot of really good examples across the city of really positive collaborations with communities and developers. I talk a lot about Honest Ed's or The Well or other projects across the city where we've met, you know, the expectations of the community and we've met the aspirations of the developer.
Right.
And the OMB stays over there. And that's the way you build the city. You kind of, you know, you want to go off to the OMB. Maybe, you know, that's necessary sometimes, but I would rather focus my energy and my efforts and my resources on a collaboration where, again, I think we've demonstrated over and over again that we can get stuff done and grow the city. The city is growing. There's 273 cranes, so something's going right.
Right.
And, you know, the subtleties
of... Good work, by the way.
Yeah, yeah, but the subtleties of the OMB and the LPAT, I'd rather, you know, save that for those who feel that you can get, you know, have problem solves through an adversarial process. I'm less interested in that kind of conversation.
Right.
Even on the basis, I was just thinking of like your prior comments on mobility and stuff like that, because I had a selfish question in here talking about traffic congestion for high-rise residential neighborhoods.
Yes. You must live in one.
I live in Liberty Village. And then I was always looking
at
that corner.
Do you ride your bike to work?
No. Streetcar.
You could start there.
Walk and then streetcar. Okay. So the King Street pilot project is a dream.
You must like that. Yeah,
oh,
you must like
goodness.
That.
20 minutes to work. It's just, it's wonderful.
Yeah.
But
you almost have a bridge too.
That was the point bridge, that I was going to make.
The new bridge open, or the second bridge.
Yeah, the one on the east
Duro
side.
The Street Bridge.
Yeah, and then there's the one that's in Liberty Village proper that's just opening up. But like that clues into the fact of the mobility of having pedestrian foot traffic with the higher residential neighborhood, even though the streets are unfortunately narrow and they're locked by bridges on both sides, where you can't really expand the road at all. But, you know, the pedestrian footbridges will alleviate a lot of that traffic, as well as, you know, bicycles and stuff like that. So, just it's like not a question, it's a comment. Okay.
My question's already been answered.
You cannot, I mean,
I was just like, wow, that clued all in there.
So you've answered your own question.
Yes, no,
because
exactly.
We're just using the available finite space more smartly than we have before. And you think about moving people instead of counting cars. If you change the metric to moving people, you're going to make that road space a lot more efficient if you decide to use it differently. And that's what we did with King Street, where you started counting the amount of space that's used up by cars, and then amount number of people in them versus people on foot or using or in riding in a streetcar. And you quickly see through the data that you're going to do a lot better, more efficiently moving people when you give the streetcar an edge, which is what we did with the design for King Street.
Yeah. It's wonderful.
So
it took a moment, but people are getting used to it.
They're getting used to it. And, you know, Toronto is kind of a funny place when it comes to changing mindsets. But these once these opportunities get run, we do a lot of pilots here in the city. It's kind of the Toronto way. But people, I think, come along and you kind of change the conversation bit by bit. And once you get something on the ground here, I think it means a lot. Bike lanes are the same thing. I mean, people travel all over the world and they glow about bike lanes and separated cycle tracks in other cities. And then they come back here and they complain. And I think people need to put two and two together a little bit more and understand the potential that we've got with that finite road space that we have, using it more smartly and moving people. It's also about, you know, creating better places. We talked about livability earlier and making that street more amenable to human beings. You know, that's what it's all about. Which in turn, I think, supports the prosperity of the street and the investment that can come on that street. The restaurants in Toronto come and go, and I'm not in the restaurant business. So far from me to judge, but I think there's lots of opportunity, and we've seen that through the data, and it was important using that data to evaluate the impact of King Street. But we've seen that level of variability on King Street be not unlike a level of variability on other streets. So we were kind of, I think, very careful and smart about how we went about coming to a conclusion that that was a really positive change for the city.
Well, for sure. And like the pilot project has been on for a while now, and the restaurants haven't closed.
Well, a few have come and gone, but I would say that restaurants come and go. And again, I'm not in that business, but I think you get that normal activity in a big city like Toronto.
Yeah. It's not a mass vacant street or something like that. It's like, it's still, people are still there. People are still moving.
You know, what needs to happen next is we need to continue to improve the public realm and think about the street differently. And but we can't forget the metric. Like you're 20 minutes to work, you said, and we can't forget that we've made it, you know, quicker for people to get to work. But I think most importantly, it's more reliable. So you can now, you know, almost like walking, it used to be faster walking, but you can decide to leave at 8 o'clock for a 8:30 meeting. And you'll know that that streetcar is coming on a 4-minute interval. That's really important. That's important during the day for the local mobility around the downtown. And that's the same way with bike share and some of these other things that we can do to give people options to move about and meet the needs of their daily routine and daily life. You know, think about it through that lens and make that mobility network work for them.
We don't have, it's 6:08. Just recognizant of time here.
Okay.
So maybe first, Preya, do you have any questions?
No, we've always talked about the dots that I had.
Okay. Okay. Just wanted to make sure that you're included.
Can I ask you? Because I still have so many questions, and to be careful of your time, can you just give me like maybe one sentence answers for these questions?
I can try.
Okay. What do you think about the Portlands? Is there anything on the docket from the city?
One sentence answer on the Portlands?
Dude,
it's a 50 year kind of plan.
That's the sentence. Yeah, okay. That's
the 50 year plan. You know what? The river is under construction. I think one of the most remarkable transformations in the city's history of putting the river mouth back where it was for centuries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the way it used to work. And for a pause of about 100 years, we had this industrial Portlands, but we're putting the river back, and that is going to be transformational. People are going to go there within 5 years and see something completely new, and that's going to set the stage for new mixed-use communities, Villiers Island, but also, you know, we're continuing to see the investment in film studio industry and all the economic changes that are coming with that. There's a lot of room. It's deceiving. There's a lot of room in the Portlands for gradual incremental change. So there's enough room for, you know, building new housing on Villiers Island, but there's also still enough room for more studio expansion. So we're going to see both, and that's going to play over the next couple of decades.
Right. And still retained by the city with, you know, 100-year leases and that kind of thing?
I don't know. That's for smarter that's minds than
longer,
than
longer
me.
Than one
yeah.
sentence. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
What else did I have? You have a few million dollars. Where do you put it in the city? That's an investment question.
Yes, where would you personally invest?
You mean real estate investment?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, geez. I don't know. I'll leave that to you guys to sort out. I'm in the public sector, and if you're going to give me as a chief planner, I'm going to take a couple of million dollars that you're going to give me, and I'm going to invest it in high impact, low cost. I'll tell you where I'm going to spend it. I'm going to spend it on the bus rapid transit network to make people move around more quickly and easily in the suburbs.
Okay. Okay. Fair. Today was transit day, you mentioned, or tomorrow's?
Tomorrow is a executive committee for the transit package, yeah.
Okay. What is happening there? Anything big?
Province has proposed four priority transit investments. The Ontario line, which is a version of what the city was thinking about with the North and South Relief line, extending from the Science Center over to Ontario Place, down through the alignment of the rail network, in part. Also, the Scarborough Subway extension, a three-stop version of that. An extension north on the Yonge Line to Richmond Hill, and the Eglinton West LRT extension. So those are all projects that the province is going to prioritize in advance. They have announced, and we've reported on the fact that they no longer wish to upload the subway system. So we think that in total, the way to go forward is to work with them, and we're recommending, we've done an initial review, especially of the Ontario line, because parts of it are new. We've done an initial line review of that, and we think we can recommend it in principle. There's a lot of detailed work to do, especially where it carves through some of the East End. But we think there's enough there to work with them collaboratively to advance what's sorely needed in the city, which is an expansion of the transit network. That report sets up a number of recommendations for agreements. You know, we need to work with them, but we need to have agreements about our relationship so that we all know what each other is doing and our roles and responsibilities. So that report outlines all of that.
Okay. I was just going to go for the last one to be careful.
Go for it.
All right. So this one's not written on the sheet, but this question we ask all our guests is called the Three Truths. Right?
Get ready.
Okay. So imagine years from now, you know, you're 100 years old and you lived a very successful life, and accomplished everything that you wanted to do personally and for the city of Toronto or wherever you might be at that time, 100 years from now.
Whoa, but, pretty old.
Yeah, it's very successful life. Yeah. But for whatever reason, all of the interviews that you've ever done, all of the books that you've ever written, they've all been erased. And you have 3 short notes to pass on to your family and friends and the people who love you.
Whoa.
About life or planning or whatever you want to think about.
Yeah.
What would you put on those notes?
Well, I would go back to my values. I'm pretty centered on how they're tried and true. And when you have a problem that you don't know the answer to, if you go back to the guidance that they can provide you, you'll find the answer, or you'll be able to locate someone who can help you find that answer. So I would definitely go back to those values. You said there were 3?
Yep.
3, yeah.
3 short notes.
3 short notes. So go back to your values. Those are pretty all-encompassing. So I would also emphasize, you know, multi-generational responsibility, that you are only here for a short time. Maybe it's 100 years, but you've got that longer term. You've got to remember that you've got a longer term responsibility for people who come after you that you haven't met yet. You know, a lot of new people coming to Toronto. So don't just think about yourself and don't just think about the here and now, but think really longer term. Third one. Jeez.
It's not easy.
Just remember to get a lot of sleep and eat regular meals. That's the best I can do.
I think that was the opposite of what my brother said on this.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. Yeah.
He said sleep is for the weak or something. Oh, like that. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh no, it isn't.
Yeah. That was his thing, yeah.
Okay, well, thank you so much. It's so interesting how you think about city planning, and obviously we're real estate guys, and we think about the profit a lot of times, but there's so much more to consider.
You got
to
expand your horizon.
Well, maybe. not just yet.
There are many bottom lines to bottom lines to life, not just your profit.
That's the quote of the year. Okay, yeah. Thank you so much. Thanks for coming.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Greg. Thanks.